Hirschhorn had been able to identify only long stretches of DNA where a genetic variant seemed to be lurking. The variants might reside in one of hundreds of genes in those regions. It was even possible that Hirschhorn's results were a fluke that had nothing to do with height. A number of tall people might have a version of a particular marker, thanks simply to chance. Hirschhorn was not alone in his frustration. Many other scientists were trying to trace traits, especially hereditary risks for certain diseases, to specific genes. At first, they enjoyed some high-profile successes, finding links to conditions like diabetes and bipolar disorder. But very often, the links would melt away when other scientists looked at larger groups of people. Soon, scientists worried that they were stuck in a dead end. "Has the genetic study of complex disorders reached its limits?" two scientists asked in a 1996 article in the journal Science. Those two scientists, Neil Risch of Stanford University and Kathleen Merikangas of Yale, argued that the answer was no. But to uncover the variants that raise the risk of common diseases, scientists would have to build new tools. Risch and Merikangas predicted that most variants would not be powerful, as in the case of Laronne syndrome and acromegaly. Instead, the variants behind many diseases would be weak and numerous. Risch and Merikangas sketched out a new way to carry out this search. Geneticists needed to step away from their beloved pedigrees. Instead, they needed to look at the DNA of hundreds of people, with no regard to their families. They could search for variants that were unusually common in people with a disease, compared to those who did not suffer from it. Risch and Merikangas dubbed their hypothetical method a genome-wide association study. It took until 2005 for genome-wide association studies to get their first hit. Josephine Ho, a geneticist at Yale University, wanted to find genes involved in the leading cause of blindness, a disease called age-related macular degeneration, AMD for short, that ravages the center of the retina. Ho knew that having a relative with AMD raised the odds that people would develop it in their own life, but studies on families with AMD had failed to reveal a gene associated with the disease. Ho and her colleagues gathered DNA from 96 people who had AMD, as well as from 50 people who didn't. They scanned the genetic markers and noticed an unusually common one among people with AMD, located on chromosome 1. Closely examining that region, they came across a variant in a gene for a protein made by immune cells called complement factor H. They found that having two copies of the variant drastically raised a person's odds of developing AMD. The job of complement factor H is to stick to pathogens, triggering inflammation to fight them. Ho's research indicated that mutant forms of the protein stick instead to retinal cells, causing the immune system to attack the eye. Ho's findings were later confirmed in other studies, but with such a small group of people in her study, she might very well have missed complement factor H if its effects had been any weaker. She was right, and she was also lucky. To use genome-wide association studies to find subtler variants, scientists recognized they would have to study thousands or even millions of people. In 2007, a consortium of laboratories working through the Wellcome Trust in England published the first such large-scale study. Examining 14,000 people, they identified 24 genes with variants that raised the risk of diseases such as diabetes and arthritis. After his own frustrating experience studying the height of families, Hirschhorn also turned to genome-wide association studies. He and his colleagues used some of the data from the Wellcome Trust study, adding to it people who had been part of a diabetes study in Sweden. All told, nearly 5,000 people became part of the study. The technology for sequencing genetic markers had improved drastically since Hirschhorn had started investigating height. Now, instead of looking at a few hundred markers, he could look at a few hundred thousand of them. The denser spread of genetic markers made it possible to zero in on smaller regions containing fewer genes. This time, Hirschhorn got a solid hit. One variant, located in a gene called HMGA2, was significantly more common in tall people than in short ones, so common, in fact, that it couldn't be dismissed as a fluke. Hirschhorn and his colleagues tested the association by looking at HMGA2 in more than 29,000 other people. In the bigger group, taller people once again were much more likely to carry the same variant of HMGA2. Yet Hirschhorn couldn't say how precisely HMGA2 influenced people's height. A few experiments carried out over the years offered a handful of clues. In experiments with mice, some mutations to HMGA2 could turn the animals into dwarves. Others turned them into giants, by mouse standards. The evidence about HMGA2's function in humans was even scarcer. In 2005, geneticists at Harvard Medical School published a case report on an 8-year-old boy who had a mutation clipping his HMGA2 gene short. He seemed normal at birth, but at 3 months he sprouted his first tooth. By the time the boy was 8 years old, he was over 5'5", the average height for a 15-year-old. His legs and fingers grew crookedly, and he developed lumps of fat and blood vessels under some parts of his skin. These studies suggest that HMGA2 normally acts like a brake, slowing down our growth-spurring genes. A mutation that shuts down HMGA2 entirely may cause runaway growth. The common variant in HMGA2 that increases height may lift the genetic foot off the brake just enough to make people grow a bit taller, but not enough to lead to deformities or tumors. The discovery of HMGA2 was like a quarter-carat sapphire, solid, glittering, and tiny. It marked the first time that scientists found a common variant strongly associated with height. Later, when other scientists studied even larger groups of people, they confirmed the link. But the HMGA2 variant accounts for a vanishingly small amount of the variation in the human population. When I got my genome sequenced, I found that I carry one copy of the height-raising form. On average, people with one copy are about an eighth of an inch taller than if they didn't have one. That's the equivalent of putting on a warm pair of wool socks. If I had two copies, it would be like putting on a second pair. And when scientists look at the full range of variation in height, they find that this variant in HMGA2 explains very little, only about 0.2%. Hirschhorn's 2007 study also uncovered some tantalizing clues about many other genes. They contained variants that were more common in tall people than in short ones, or vice versa. But the differences weren't as stark as HMGA2, leaving open the possibility they were the result of chance. To rule out randomness, Hirschhorn would need to measure more people's heights. Hirschhorn and his colleagues created a new network of hundreds of research groups around the world. They called their consortium the Genetic Investigation of Anthropometric Traits, GIANT for short. The GIANT team examined the height of tens of thousands of people, then hundreds of thousands, and the bigger numbers allowed them to pick out more genetic variants, first dozens, then hundreds. Most of the genes they discovered had a smaller influence than HMGA2, but they also found a number of genes that had a far bigger one. If people carry two variants of a gene called STC2, for example, those alleles will lift them up about an inch and a half. These powerful genes had gone overlooked in earlier studies of height because they were too rare, found in less than 5% of the population. In 2017, a decade after the first genome-wide association study of height, GIANT published a study on more than 700,000 people, bringing the total number of genes influencing height to almost 800. To some observers, however, such results seemed like a colossal disappointment. The combined effect of GIANT's 800-odd genes accounted for just over 27% of the heritability of height. The rest remained missing. Height was not unusual in this regard. Missing heritability dogged many studies of other traits and diseases, too, even after scientists could study thousands of people. The shortfall was all the more glaring because of all the money that had gone into making genome-wide association studies possible. The reason for spending so much money was that the bulk of the heritability would be discovered, the geneticist Joseph Nadeau told a journalist. Some critics saw missing heritability as much more than an annoyance. To them, it was a symptom of a scientific disease. In 2015, two French researchers, Emmanuel Genet and Françoise Clerget-Darpoux, argued that missing heritability revealed the futility of genome-wide association studies. Genet and Clerget-Darpoux described the research as garbage-in, garbage-out syndrome. The scientists running the studies were trying to use brute force to discover the deepest secrets of biology, yet their repeated failures simply led them to redouble their efforts and journal editors to publish more of their papers. To Genet and Clerget-Darpoux, it seemed as if geneticists had become trapped in a game they couldn't stop playing. Unfortunately, genetics is a clear loser, they concluded. Other critics say that missing heritability reveals our profound ignorance about heritability itself. Some attacked twin studies, claiming they lead to estimates of heritability that are much too high. Others argued that heritability studies miss the way some mutations make the effects of other mutations stronger. 1+1 in the world of heredity may be far more than 2. Some critics went even further, arguing that missing heritability is hiding beyond genes, in some other form of heredity scientists have yet to grasp. When I asked Hirschhorn if missing heritability was giving him existential doubts, he shrugged the problem off. "I think a lot of it is just hidden," he told me. "If we had all 6 billion people on Earth in a genetic study, we would actually get to most of the heritability." Part of Hirschhorn's confidence came from his own experience over the previous 20 years. The more people he and his colleagues measured, the more heritability they could explain. Some of the genes they found were common but weak, while others were strong but rare. If he could study more people in the future, he expected to find more of both kinds. Hirschhorn also drew confidence from the work of Peter Visscher, who has given geneticists a new way to study human heritability. Visscher came to research on humans after years of work on livestock. Animal breeders study the heritability of cows to figure out how to get them to make more milk, of pigs to put on more pork. In the 1900s, they used elaborate pedigrees to track the influence of genes on these traits. But at the end of the century, breeders got their hands on technology for reading genetic markers in their animals. At first, they searched for candidate genes that might have a big effect on their own. Soon it became clear that a trait like milk output was controlled by many genes, each with a tiny effect. Animal breeders found that they could improve their livestock by comparing all their genetic markers in different animals. Animals that were genetically similar overall tended to have similar traits. Breeders could choose which animals to breed based on these so-called genomic predictions. When Visscher switched from animals to humans in the early 2000s, he realized that he could use genomic predictions on people, too. Visscher and his colleagues took the method out of the barnyard and adapted it to human genetics, dubbing their method genome-wide complex trait analysis. To see how well it worked, they unleashed it on the best-studied complex trait of all, human height. The researchers delved into the data from earlier genome-wide association studies and looked at the genetic markers from thousands of people. They came up with genetic similarity scores between each pair of people. Heredity turned out to work a lot in humans as it does in chickens. Pairs of people with high scores tended to have similar heights. That tendency reflects the heritability of a trait. The stronger the tendency, the greater the heritability. When Visscher and his colleagues estimated the heritability of human height from genetic similarity, they ended up with a number close to what had been estimated in earlier studies on families and twins. In 2015, when they published these results in the journal Nature Genetics, they declared the missing heritability of height to be negligible. Toward the end of my visit with Hirschhorn, I noticed his eyes drifting to the clock on his desk phone. He had a conference call coming up soon with a lot of his collaborators. They were about to take another leap from 800,000 people to perhaps 2 million. But before I left, Hirschhorn explained that the years of work he had put into the inheritance of height were not simply to create a catalog of genes. He wanted to use the catalog to understand the mysteries of height. If you stop and think through what it means to grow, the process is astonishing. Each part of the body has to change its shape and size to match every other part. There's no central blueprint for the construction of an adult human. Each cell has to decide for itself, using nothing more than chemical signals and its own network of genes, RNA molecules, and proteins. As Hirschhorn's list of genes has grown, he and his colleagues have searched them for patterns. They turn out not to be a random assortment. Most of the action is at the growth plate, Hirschhorn said. Growth plates are thin layers of cells located near the ends of limb bones. In children, some of the cells in the plates produce signals, which then trigger neighboring cartilage cells to multiply. As the cells divide, the bones get longer. Eventually, the cartilage cells change, producing bone instead. They finally commit suicide, tearing themselves open to dump out chemicals that make the surrounding bone even harder. Hirschhorn and his colleagues found that many of the genes on their list are unusually active in growth plate cells. Obviously, other parts of the body have to grow as well in order for people to become taller, but it's possible that the growth plates lead the parade. Mutations to the genes used by growth plate cells speed up or slow down the increase in limb bones. The rest of the parade has to adjust its speed to follow the leader. Yet Hirschhorn knew that he would have to find other stories to tell about height. HMGA2, the first gene he and his colleagues discovered influencing height, remained the strongest common variant. It's active in embryonic cells, not in growth plates in children. And despite a lot of research by Hirschhorn and his graduate students, he still couldn't say why it's so important. "That one still boggles my mind," Hirschhorn admitted. It's possible that Hirschhorn will have to become a Scheherazade of the genome to tell all the stories about how the genes we inherit influence our height. In 2017, Jonathan Pritchard, the scientist who invented structure, tried to predict how many genes scientists would ultimately find linked to height. Would Hirschhorn reach 1,000 genes and be able to close down his shop? Pritchard thinks the answer is a definite no. For their study, Pritchard and his colleagues took a closer look at a genome-wide association study that Hirschhorn and his colleagues published in 2014. In that study, Hirschhorn's team scanned 2.4 million genetic markers in 250,000 people. They looked for variants at each of the markers with a very strong link to height, so strong that they could confidently reject the possibility that the links were just coincidences. That study gave Hirschhorn and his colleagues a list of about 700 strongly supported genes, but they also found many other ambiguous variants that didn't quite meet their strict standards. Those variants might have a weak effect on height, or they might simply have turned up in Hirschhorn's study by chance. Pritchard used new statistical techniques on those ambiguous variants to see if he could separate the genetic wheat from the chaff. He and his colleagues looked for people who carried two copies of each variant and checked their height. Then they looked at the height of people with only one copy of the variant, and that of people with no copies. In many cases, this comparison revealed a small but measurable effect. Two copies of a variant might make people shorter than average, while one copy made them a little taller, and no copies made them taller still. Pritchard and his colleagues then turned to an entirely different group of 20,000 people to test these results. They found the same effects from the same variants. What made this study startling was just how many of these variants Pritchard and his colleagues found. At 77% of the markers they studied, almost 2 million spots in people's DNA, in other words, they could detect an influence on height. The markers were not clumped around a few genes on one chromosome. They were instead spread out across all the chromosomes, encompassing the entire human genome. These variants likely altered the sequence of many genes, changing the structure of their proteins. But they probably also changed the regions of DNA that act like switches to turn the genes on and off. Each of the nearly 2 million variants had, on average, an exquisitely tiny effect, adding or subtracting the width of a human hair. But collectively, this vast army of weak variants accounted for much more variation in height than the strongest genes that Hirschhorn and his colleagues put together in their catalog. Traditionally, geneticists have called height polygenic, meaning many genes. Pritchard thinks a new word is called for, omnigenic. If height really is omnigenic, as Pritchard believes, we may need to rethink the way our cells work. There may be a core group of genes lurking in growth plates that take the lead in determining how tall we get. But some of those genes also have other jobs. They work with other genes and other kinds of cells. You can think of our genes as a set of networks. There's a network of genes that work together in growth plate cells. And you can draw a line from some of those genes to other networks. Thanks to the way these networks are organized, it may take only a few steps to go from any given gene to any other gene in the human genome. With all these connections, a mutation to a single gene can have wide-ranging effects. It can alter a gene that has nothing directly to do with height, but its influence can reach across the networks to affect the ones that do. In science's hunt for how we inherit height, scientists may have to expand their search to the entire genome. Chapter 10, Ed and Fred. In 1864, when Francis Galton was 42, he posed for a photograph. He was now middle-aged and had grown a beard girdling his jaw. His forehead rose into a high, hairless dome. Galton leaned his left hand on a bookshelf next to a globe, the icon of the geographer. A chair stood next to him, a top hat sitting on the seat, the brim turned up like an open pot. The scrolled back of the chair reached almost to the level of Galton's hip. It served as accidental measuring tape, documenting his generous height. The photograph, in other words, is a typical picture of a tall Victorian gentleman. A mass of about 37 trillion 19th century cells nurtured through years of divisions by a wealthy British childhood. Galton inherited that wealth, but not through his genes. His great-great-grandfather, Joseph Farmer, opened a small smithy in Birmingham in the early 1700s, where he made a modest living producing sword blades and gun parts. In 1717, Farmer took a big gamble that paid off for generations. Traveling to the American colonies, he set up forges and furnaces in Maryland, where he could smelt the iron from nearby mines. He shipped the metal back to his factories in Birmingham, where his workers could then craft them into more expensive goods. Thanks to the efforts of businessmen like Farmer, Maryland became one of the world's main iron suppliers in the 18th century. Farmer would brag about his plantation iron, a name it earned for a very simple and lucrative reason. Maryland's ironworks relied heavily on the labor of African slaves. When Farmer died in 1741, his son James inherited the business, which by then specialized in gunlock springs and musket barrels. His family invested some of the profits in slave trade companies in Lisbon, bringing them even greater riches. 5 years later, James's sister married Francis Galton's great-grandfather Samuel. Samuel Galton had been a draper of modest means, but his new brother-in-law hired him as an assistant. It wasn't long before Samuel became a partner in the firm. Guns and slavery grew even more intertwined in the Galton family fortune. By the 1750s, the Galtons were delivering more than 25,000 guns a year to European traders, who sold the weapons to African states engaged in increasingly bloody battles. The warring states captured prisoners in the fights, and then sold them to European slave traders. Before long, they demanded to be paid for the slaves with more guns instead of gold. Samuel Galton took sole control of the firm and began to supply arms to the British government, which used his muskets against American rebels. When Samuel Galton's son, Samuel John Galton, came of age, he joined the firm, and together the two Samuels grew their business for a few decades. When he died, Samuel had amassed £139,000. His fortune had been the fruit of God's blessing on his industry, Galton's granddaughter later said. The Galtons were a pious family of Quakers, but by the end of the 1700s, the wealth they made from war and slavery had largely turned the Society of Friends against them. In 1790, a faction of Quakers tried to bar the Galtons from their monthly meetings. Delegations of wealthy Quakers tried to persuade the Galtons to get into a different line of work. Samuel the Elder agreed to stop taking profits from the family's gun business, but Samuel the Younger refused. He wouldn't even admit he was doing anything wrong. In a letter read to the monthly meeting in Birmingham in 1796, he cast himself as a helpless prisoner of heredity. "The trade devolved upon me as if it were an inheritance," he declared. "My engagements in the business were not a matter of choice." The Quakers didn't buy that excuse. They barred him from their meetings for life. 8 years later, perhaps out of some delayed remorse, Samuel Galton abandoned the gun business to his son, Francis's father, and busied himself with opening a new bank. In 1815, Samuel Tertius Galton closed down the gun business for good. The Industrial Revolution had arrived in Birmingham, and the family bank's investments in factories and canals were proving profitable. By the time Francis Galton was born in 1822, the family fortune had swelled to £300,000. As a child, Francis proved to be a prodigy, reciting passages of Shakespeare from memory and discussing the finer points of the Iliad. Despite their wealth, the Galtons always felt like outsiders, in part because no one in their family had completed a university education. They loaded their hopes for legitimacy on Francis's small shoulders. At age 4, when Tertius asked his son what he hoped for most of all, Francis replied, "Why, university honors, to be sure." They never came. At age 18, when Galton went to Cambridge, his father stocked his rooms with everything a young gentleman at university needed, from silver teaspoons to a steady supply of wine. Above his fireplace, Francis mounted crossed foils and pistols. In a small room next to his bedroom lived his three servants. Once he was settled in, Galton set out to study mathematics, aiming to take the honors examination known as the tripos. To improve his concentration, he bought a gumption reviver, a contraption that dripped water on his head and had to be refilled by a servant every 15 minutes. He hired a tutor with a reputation for brilliance to teach him math. Despite all his promise and spending, Galton received third-class honors on his first-year exams, the equivalent of a gentleman's C. In the hopes of improving his scores, Galton hired an even better math tutor, who accompanied him and four fellow students on a reading party in the Lake District. When it came time to take his first major exam, nicknamed Little Go, Galton made only second class. In a letter to his father, Galton made light about the score, boasting about going into the Little Go when I had not read over half my subjects and coming out unplucked. In truth, he was bitterly disappointed to watch his friends, who had studied with the same tutors at the same reading parties, get first honors. One of Galton's tutors urged him to give up his childhood hope. He should simply finish up Cambridge, as most students did, and take a so-called pole degree. Galton refused. Pole degrees were for the mediocre. Instead, he hired a new math tutor and went to Scotland for another reading party. This time, the stress of studying gave Galton a nervous breakdown. "A mill seemed to be working inside my head," he later recalled. Looking back at the crisis he went through in the fall of 1842, Galton concluded he had pushed his brain too far. "It was as though I had tried to make a steam engine perform more work than it was constructed for." For a few more months, Galton kept up the illusion of a top student. He wrangled a certificate of degradation from one of his tutors, which allowed him to put off his final honors examination for another year. He distracted himself from heart palpitations and dizzy spells with wine parties, poetry, and hockey. It was all a facade, one that collapsed when his father suddenly died. Galton left Cambridge with a pole degree and inherited his father's fortune. He was mediocre, yet rich beyond compare. Galton's failure at Cambridge left him forever insecure about his own standing in the scientific world, always seeking to bask in the genius of others. He would later look back at his Cambridge years with gratitude that he had spent time with the highest intellects of their age. Their high intellects may well have inspired Galton's obsession with heredity. He was struck by the many obvious cases of heredity among the Cambridge men who were at the university about my own time. The students who got the highest honors at Cambridge were exquisitely rare, and yet they generally seemed to have a father, a brother, or some other male relative who had gotten high honors as well. Galton didn't think that was a coincidence. In later years, this observation mushroomed into a fervent conviction. In Galton's 1869 book, Hereditary Genius, he declared that human intellectual abilities are derived by inheritance under exactly the same limitations as are the form and physical features of the whole organic world. Galton believed intelligence, like height, was deeply rooted in biology, so deep that it could be inherited. To persuade his readers, he needed a way to measure intelligence in relatives. But in the 1860s, no one knew how to do that. For a crude approximation, Galton got his hands on the scores of 73 boys who took the admission tests to the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. The scores, he was pleased to discover, roughly followed a bell curve, much like the one he found for height. Most of the boys scored close to average, while the curve tapered off in either direction to what Galton would call stupidity and genius. He lingered lovingly over the scores of Cambridge students who earned honors in mathematics, drawing up a table in which fewer and fewer students managed to reach higher and higher scores. Yet Galton considered even the lowest scoring Cambridge honors students to be brilliant in comparison to the majority of English people. The average mental grasp of even of what is called a well-educated audience will be found to be ludicrously small when rigorously tested, Galton declared. He never mentioned where he himself fit into that Cambridge continuum. Galton then gathered evidence for heredity. He followed up on his intuition about his bright college mates at Cambridge, researching their genealogies and building a pedigree of the mind. Galton claimed his data showed that high-scoring students had high-scoring kin. He looked for other examples from history, investigating presidents and scientists and composers, more than 1,000 men of talent all told. Women barely counted in his argument. Height and intelligence would remain the twin guideposts for Galton. When thousands of visitors came to his anthropometric laboratory, he not only recorded their height, but also timed their reactions and recorded the circumference of their heads, two traits Galton suspected were related to intelligence. But when Galton developed eugenics, height and intelligence would take on very different roles in his thinking. When he dreamed about his hereditary utopia, it was intelligence that he wanted to breed. He pictured a nation of geniuses, not giants. Galton's disciple Carl Pearson pursued more research on intelligence at the same time as he studied height. He asked teachers at hundreds of London schools to describe their students, picking the most apt words for each one from a list of adjectives such as slow and quick. When Pearson tallied up the replies and ranked them, he ended up with a bell curve. To see if heredity played a part in the intelligence of the students, Pearson compared siblings. He found that the ability of siblings was correlated. The siblings of low-scoring students tended to score low as well. The quick ones tended to have quicker siblings. Pearson was impressed that the correlation of intelligence was much like the correlation for physical traits. We inherit the mental abilities of our parents, Pearson declared, even as we inherit their stature, forearm, and span. Yet Pearson's argument for the inheritance of intelligence suffered from a fundamental weakness. For his measurements, he had to rely on the gut instincts of teachers. In the 1910s, Henry Goddard and other American psychologists replaced those subjective scores with Binet-based test results. And instead of studying hundreds of people, they tested millions. To Goddard's collaborator, Lewis Terman, the Army tests confirmed that intelligence was primarily the result of heredity. Among Army recruits, immigrants scored lower on average than native-born soldiers. The immigrants who have recently come to us in such large numbers from southern and southeastern Europe are distinctly inferior mentally to the Nordic and Alpine strains which we received from Scandinavia, Germany, Great Britain, and France, Terman said. Intelligence, the tests made clear, was chiefly a matter of native endowment, and so, these are differences which the highest arts of pedagogy are powerless to neutralize. Terman was so convinced of the inheritance of intelligence that he ignored his own data. His test results showed that the longer immigrants lived in the United States, the higher they scored on intelligence tests. Terman and his colleagues built their tests from questions steeped in everyday American life, which required familiarity as well as intellect. Recruits were shown a picture of a tennis game to see if they noticed the net was missing. They were quizzed about the color of sapphires. They had to complete sentences such as, "The Percheron is a kind of," answer, "horse." As it became clear that intelligence test scores could be influenced by people's cultural backgrounds, some psychologists tried to strip that background away. One psychologist, named Stanley Porteous, decided to avoid language altogether by testing people with mazes. He designed mazes of different levels of complexity and had them printed. Traveling across Australia, Asia, and Africa, he searched for people with little contact with the West who he could examine. Porteous found that the so-called Bushmen of the Kalahari scored a mental age of 7. Yet his subjects were navigating their way through Porteous's printed mazes in the middle of a vast desert that they could navigate without a map, finding all the food and shelter they required. When he presented his results in 1937, Porteous recognized that even a wordless maze test might be skewed by culture. "The maze is by itself far from being a satisfactory measure of intelligence," he said. In fact, the experience left him wondering what his tests were measuring. "All we can say of it is that the complex of qualities needed for its performance seemed to be valuable in making adjustments to our kind of society," Porteous said. Other researchers have argued that intelligence isn't merely what it takes to survive in one society. They maintain it's a deep-seated feature of the human brain. The neuroscientist Richard Heyer, for example, has defined intelligence as a catch-all word that means the mental abilities most related to responding to everyday problems and navigating the environment. These abilities are not a random disconnected collection of skills, tests show. When scientists give people tests on different abilities, their scores are correlated. If people are very good at recalling information from stories, for example, they also tend to do well at recalling words from lists. Different tests for logical reasoning correlate with each other as well. In turn, these broad abilities, such as reasoning, memory, spatial ability, processing speed, and vocabulary, correlate with each other. Psychologists can measure this underlying correlation with a single factor known as G, short for general intelligence. It may seem strange that the speed at which people correctly hit a button can roughly predict whether they can recognize a word like defenestrate. Yet the deep connections revealed by intelligence researchers are among the best replicated findings in all of psychology. Intelligence is also a surprisingly durable trait. On June 1, 1932, the government of Scotland tested almost every 11-year-old in the country, 87,498 all told, with a 71-question exam. The students decoded ciphers, made analogies, did arithmetic. The Scottish Council for Research in Education scored the tests and analyzed the results to get an objective picture of the intelligence of Scottish children. Scotland carried out only one more nationwide exam, in 1947. Over the next couple of decades, the council analyzed the data and published monographs before their work slipped away into oblivion. In 1997, an expert on intelligence named Ian Deary stumbled across a mention of the Scottish Mental Survey in a book. Given his line of work, and given that he worked at the University of Edinburgh, he was startled that he had never heard of it before. The book Deary was reading only mentioned the survey in passing, but it was enough to inspire him to find out more about it. Intelligence testing was so time-consuming that researchers typically could manage to examine small groups of people. Here was a test of an entire population, and all the 11-year-old test takers who were still alive would now be 76. At the time, psychologists were still debating how much intelligence tests taken in childhood said about people's later lives. If Deary could find some of them, he could give them the test once more and get an unprecedented measurement of this influence. Deary's colleague, Lawrence Whaley, dug into the Scottish Mental Survey reports. Eventually, his search led him to a basement stacked with boxes and files containing the original tests. He called Deary with the news. "This will change our lives," Deary replied. Deary, Whaley, and their colleagues moved the 87,498 tests from ledgers onto computers. They then investigated what had become of the test takers. Their ranks included soldiers who died in World War II, along with a bus driver, a tomato grower, a bottle labeler, a manager of a tropical fish shop, a member of an Antarctic expedition, a cardiologist, a restaurant owner, and an assistant in a doll hospital. The researchers decided to track down all the surviving test takers in a single city, Aberdeen. They were slowed down by the misspelled names and erroneous birth dates. Many of the Aberdeen examinees had died by the late 1990s. Others had moved to other parts of the world, and still others were just unreachable. But on June 1, 1998, 101 elderly people assembled at the Aberdeen Music Hall, exactly 66 years after they had gathered there as 11-year-olds to take the original test. Deary had just broken both his arms in a bicycling accident, but he would not miss the historic event. He rode a train 120 miles from Edinburgh to Aberdeen, up to his elbows in plaster, to witness them taking their second test. Back in Edinburgh, Deary and his colleagues scored the tests. Deary pushed a button on his computer to calculate the correlation between their scores as children and as senior citizens. The computer spat back a result of 73%. In other words, the people who had gotten relatively low scores in 1932 tended to get relatively low scores in 1998, while the high-scoring children tended to score high in old age. If you had looked at the score of one of the 11-year-olds in 1933, you'd have been able to make a pretty good prediction of their score almost seven decades later. Deary's research prompted other scientists to look for other predictions they could make from childhood intelligence test scores. They do fairly well at predicting how long people stay in school and how highly they will be rated at work. The U.S. Air Force found that the variation in G among its pilots could predict virtually all the variation in tests of their work performance. While intelligence test scores don't predict how likely people are to take up smoking, they do predict how likely they are to quit. In a study of 1 million people in Sweden, scientists found that people with lower intelligence test scores were more likely to get into accidents. The long reach of intelligence suggests that it may have some deep biological foundations. Some scientists have proposed that, in one way or another, different intelligence tests all probe how efficiently the brain processes information. Some of the most compelling evidence for this theory comes from a simple exam in which a shape flashes on a computer screen. The shape is made up of two vertical lines and a horizontal one sitting on top, like a sketch of the standing stones at Stonehenge. Each time the shape appears on the screen, one of the vertical lines hangs down lower than the other. Volunteers have to indicate which one is longer. If the shape flashes too briefly, people guess at random. But if the shape lingers for long enough on the monitor, they can give the right answer most of the time. On average, people can perceive a shape correctly if they can see it for around a tenth of a second, but that sliver of time varies a little from person to person. In one study, scientists found some people needed just 0.02 seconds, while others needed 0.136 seconds. Time and again, researchers have found that there's a correlation between intelligence and inspection time. People with lower intelligence scores tend to need more time in order to recognize the shape. It's not an iron law. The correlation is about 50%. But the link is strong enough to lead scientists to wonder if there's something in common lurking under inspection time and intelligence. Even the simplest mental operations require our brains to fire neurons in a network of regions scattered throughout our heads. Regions of the middle and back of the brain gather perceptions and organize them. They then feed their own signals through long fibers, known as white matter tracts, to the front of the brain. There, we have regions that specialize in problem-solving and decision-making. The frontal regions then talk back to the others so that they can fine-tune their gathering of perceptions. But Deary's research raises the possibility that the roots of intelligence dig even deeper. When he and his colleagues started examining Scottish test takers in the late 1990s, many had already died. Studying the records of 2,230 of the students, they found that the ones who had died by 1997 had, on average, a lower test score than the ones who were still alive. About 70% of the women who scored in the top quarter were still alive, while only 45% of the women in the bottom quarter were. Men had a similar split. Children who scored higher, in other words, tended to live longer. Each extra 15 IQ points, researchers have since found, translates into a 24% drop in the risk of death. In a 2017 study, Deary and his colleagues drilled further into this effect. This time around, the researchers took advantage of the second mental survey that the Scottish government carried out on 11-year-olds in 1947. This younger cohort was too young for World War II, so more of them were able to survive into old age. Deary and his colleagues combed over records for more than 65,000 of the test takers. They noted not only who died, but how they died. As before, the researchers found that lower intelligence test scores raised people's risk of death. But when they broke down the deaths into the major causes, they found the same rule held true across the board. The people who scored in the top 10% were two-thirds less likely to have died from respiratory disease than those in the bottom 10%. They were half as likely to have died from heart disease, stroke, and digestive diseases. It's possible that intelligence test scores measure how well people can take care of themselves. As adults, they may tend to make somewhat more money, which they can spend on their health, or they may be slightly better able to understand the information that their doctors give them. But the influence of intelligence on longevity is so broad that Deary has proposed a deeper connection. Scores on intelligence tests may gauge some broad feature of human biology, in the same way a thermometer or a blood pressure reading does. The efficiency in the brain may have something in common with how well other parts of the body run. And this system integrity, as Deary calls it, may help determine how long the whole system runs before falling apart. Early intelligence researchers were firmly convinced that heredity had overwhelming control over intelligence. A person can no more be trained to have it in higher degree than he can be trained to be taller, the English psychologist Charles Spearman once said. Yet the evidence they offered for these claims was as firm as a soft-boiled egg. Simply running through the annals of great English men could never deliver the proof Galton hoped for. The class prejudices of the early 1900s made it possible for an extravagant fiction like the Kallikak family to be taken seriously for years. By the 1920s, however, the science of heredity had matured far enough that researchers could begin to study intelligence in a meaningful way. This was the time that twins were emerging as a tool for studying heritability, and intelligence researchers followed the example set by those studying height. Three Chicago scientists named Frank Freeman, Carl Holzinger, and Horatio Newman gave intelligence tests to 50 identical and 50 fraternal twins. They found that the identical twins had closer scores to each other than the fraternal twins, suggesting that intelligence was indeed heritable. The Chicago researchers realized there was another way they could use twins to study intelligence. Rather than compare twins that had grown up together, they could look at how strongly nature influenced twins who had been raised apart. The scientists put out advertisements for adult twins who had been separated as children, typically adopted by different families. 19 pairs responded. One pair, whom the scientists referred to only as Ed and Fred, had grown up in different states. One day, someone walked up to Ed and said, "Hello, Fred, how's tricks?" Ed had dim memories of a long-lost brother, and so he decided it was time to track down this mysterious Fred. When the twins reunited, they were shocked to find they had both dropped out of high school and become electricians. When the scientists gave the twins an IQ test, Ed scored 91, Fred 90. When the scientists studied other separated twins, they found similarly close scores. Yet Freeman and his colleagues were cautious about the lessons they would draw from their research. We shall be satisfied if we have succeeded in tracing a few of the threads in the tangled web which constitutes the organism we call man, they said at the end of their 1937 book, Twins, A Study of Heredity and the Environment. Despite the similarity of Ed and Fred, they still agreed with the dictum, what heredity can do, environment can do also. At around the same time in London, a British psychologist named Cyril Burt was studying the intelligence of twins as well. Burt had been set on a course into psychology as a boy. His father, a doctor, sometimes let him tag along on house calls, and on one trip he met Francis Galton. After talking with Galton, Burt bought one of his books, and his fate was sealed. Burt studied at Oxford and became a teacher, carrying out psychology research on the side. In 1912, he was appointed the London City Council's first psychologist, where he used intelligence tests to identify low-scoring children in need of special education. Burt wanted to understand to what extent intelligence was a thing inborn and not acquired. Inspired by Galton's proposal, he searched among his students for twins who separated early in life. In 1955, Burt published a study on 21 pairs. Their intelligence test scores were more similar than those of siblings raised in the same house. 11 years later, Burt published an even bigger study on 53 pairs of twins. The results were the same. Burt used the test scores to estimate intelligence's heritability as being 80%. Where Freeman and his colleagues had cavilled about nature and nurture, Burt brought down his psychological gavel with a loud crack. Heredity explained most of the differences between people's intelligence test scores, he declared. Among the people who read Burt's 1966 paper was a Princeton psychologist named Leon Kamen. Within 10 minutes of starting to read Burt, Kamen recalled later, I knew in my gut that something was so fishy here that it just had to be fake. The results were too pat. They didn't seem to have anything to do with the messy nature of the real world, as Kamen put it. Kamen dug into Burt's research and found suggestions of fraud. In Burt's 1955 and 1966 studies, 20 of the correlations were identical. In both studies, the correlations between identical twins raised apart were 0.771. That three-digit coincidence alone would have been highly unlikely. 20 coincidences were astronomically improbable. Elsewhere in Burt's work, Kamen found more signs that Burt had made up much of his twin results. Burt even published papers under fake names to create the illusion that other scientists supported his findings. In 2007, a Rutgers University psychologist named William Tucker offered an explanation for Burt's long con. He was a eugenicist from start to finish. In 1909, Burt published a study showing that upper-class schoolboys scored higher on intelligence tests than lower-class ones. Their different upbringing could play only a small part in that difference, Burt declared. The superior proficiency at intelligence tests on the part of the boys of superior parentage was inborn, he wrote. Burt's scandal stained all of twin research, leading many to dismiss it as bad science. Yet just because a field attracts a fraudster doesn't make all the discipline's findings wrong. Hundreds of well-designed twin studies have come to the same conclusion. Identical twins have closer intelligence test scores than fraternal twins. Even when identical twins are raised apart, their intelligence test scores stay more similar than siblings raised together. These studies have led scientists to estimate the heritability of intelligence test scores as roughly 50%. That's substantially lower than Burt's claim of 80%, but it still indicates that heredity has an important role to play in intelligence that should not be dismissed. As these more rigorous studies piled up, they drew criticisms of their own. Some researchers complained that they relied on the assumption that the only difference between fraternal and identical twins is their genes. Some research suggested that this might not be the case. Because identical twins look alike, they may be treated as interchangeable. Fraternal twins may look different enough from each other that they have an experience more akin to their ordinary siblings. In a 2015 study, a group of researchers investigated twins who experienced bullying, sexual abuse, and other kinds of trauma. They found that identical twins had more similar experiences than fraternal twins. If one identical twin was abused, it was more likely that the other one was too. But researchers who have looked closely at the experiences of twins have concluded these effects are weak or non-existent. One such study was even carried out by a skeptic of twin studies, a Princeton sociologist named Dalton Conley. Conley realized he could investigate the experiences of twins by studying the surprising number of twins who get misclassified. Some identical twins are recorded as fraternal at birth, and fraternal ones as identical. A genetic test can easily reveal the true nature of newborn twins, but doctors apparently don't bother with it much. In a 2004 study in Japan, researchers found that hospitals misclassify as many as 30% of twins. In the Netherlands, researchers tested the DNA of 327 pairs of twins and then asked their parents what kind of twins they were. 19% of the parents gave the wrong answer. If genetic differences weren't important, then fraternal twins misclassified as identical should end up more similar to each other. You'd also expect that identical twins would be robbed of this powerful experience if their parents and teachers and everyone else around them treated them like fraternal twins. But Conley and his colleagues discovered no such thing. The cases of mistaken identity had no effect on how the twins turned out. Identical twins ended up more like each other in a range of traits, even when they didn't know they were identical. They reached more similar heights. Their risk of depression was closer. Their grades in high school were more alike. The only explanation for these similarities was heredity. Every behavior scientists have studied turns out to be partly heritable, from smoking to divorce rates to watching television. At this point, it would be astonishing if intelligence weren't heritable. But twin studies on intelligence could not say what exactly was being inherited, which genetic variants, in other words, influenced people's scores on intelligence tests. To hunt for those variants, scientists followed the trail blazed by the researchers who studied height. Scientists first linked genes to height by studying people with growth disorders like Laron syndrome. The first genes tied to intelligence also turned up in studies of intellectual disorders such as PKU. Those early discoveries brought tremendous benefits to children. They made it possible to test for a growing list of disorders and search for ways to treat them. A special diet for some, a special education program at school for others. But when it came to the heritability of intelligence, those genes were practically meaningless. The severe mutations that lead to intellectual developmental disorders are very rare. PKU affects only 1 in 10,000 people, for example. For the population as a whole, those variants say nothing about why some people score higher on intelligence tests than others. At the start of the 21st century, behavioral geneticists were full of hope that DNA sequencing technology and a map of the human genome would let them quickly find more genes that influence intelligence. In a few years, many areas of psychology will be awash in specific genes responsible for the widespread influence of genetics on behavior, Robert Plomin and John Crabb predicted in 2000. At first, it looked as if the deluge was on its way. Researchers identified genes that seemed like good candidates for influencing intelligence and studied them in ordinary people. One of those genes, called COMT, encodes an enzyme in the brain. The enzyme keeps the neurotransmitter dopamine in check. It does so by finding the dopamine molecules and chopping them to pieces. One variant of COMT produces an enzyme that chops slowly, allowing the brain's level of dopamine to rise. The slow-chopping variant is fairly common. Checking my genome, I discovered that I carry one copy of it. Many scientists suspected that the different versions of COMT might have some effect on intelligence test scores, because dopamine is crucial for memory, decision-making, and other mental tasks. The slow-chopping variant was letting more dopamine build up in people's brains, improving their performance. In 2001, Michael Egan, a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, led a study to test this idea. He and his colleagues gave 449 people an exam known as the Wisconsin Card Sorting Test. It is really just a simple game. The scientists showed the volunteers cards with circles, squares, crosses, and stars. The shapes came in different numbers and colors. The object of the test was to find sets of cards that matched each other according to a rule that Egan's team didn't tell the volunteers. Through trial and error, the volunteers eventually figured out the rule, but Egan would then switch it, leaving the volunteers to figure out the new rule. The scientists measured how quickly they made this discovery. Egan and his colleagues found that people with the slow-chopping variant of COMT performed slightly better at the game. Their success prompted other scientists to decide to see about COMT for themselves. A number of them also found a link to intelligence. It was an exciting discovery, but before long, the excitement curdled into disappointment. Later studies on more people failed to find any effect from the slow-chopping version of COMT. Other researchers tested out other candidate genes for effects on intelligence, only to watch their promising associations collapse. In hindsight, searching for candidate genes was a strategy pretty much guaranteed to fail. Our brains use 84% of our 20,000-odd protein-coding genes. Each type of neuron uses a distinctive combination of those genes, and it turns out the brain is made up of hundreds of cell types, so many that scientists will not finish its catalog for a long time. To think we could just reach into this jumble and pluck out a single gene that had a clear-cut role in intelligence was to pretend we know more about the brain than we really do. As candidate genes failed to reveal genes linked to intelligence, scientists turned to genome-wide association studies. By searching through genetic markers scattered across the genome, scientists would let the genes speak for themselves. Ian Deary led the first genome-wide association study on intelligence. As part of his research on the Scottish Mental Survey, he and his colleagues sequenced DNA from some of the test takers. Adding DNA from people who had volunteered for other studies, they analyzed 3,511 people all told. The researchers scanned 500,000 genetic markers to see if any of them were correlated with high or low levels of intelligence. Nothing on that scale had ever been attempted before. And yet, as Deary and his colleagues reported in 2011, they failed to find even one gene with any clear effect on people's intelligence test scores. The experiences Joel Hirshhorn and his colleagues had with height had prepared Deary for this kind of disappointment. Complex traits can be influenced by hundreds or even thousands of genes. Their common variants may be so weak that small studies will fail to reveal them. Making matters worse, intelligence is not an obvious trait that can be accurately measured with a simple tape measure. Psychologists may use different intelligence tests depending on who they're studying, what aspect of intelligence they want to study, or how much time they have to examine each person. To try to amass a lot of subjects for their research, scientists often merge smaller studies that used different intelligence tests. The mismatch among the tests can spread a blanket of fog over the influence of genes. Despite these challenges, genes continued to send signals from their hiding places. Peter Vischer's test for genetic similarity, which he had previously used on height, also confirmed that intelligence test scores were heritable. In fact, he could account for much of the missing heritability of intelligence. The precise amount was different depending on the age of the people the scientists studied. When Vischer and his colleagues examined 12-year-old children, they could account for a staggering 94% of the heritability of intelligence. The first genes associated with intelligence came to light in a roundabout way. Medical surveys often ask how long people stayed in school, and it turns out that educational attainment is a modestly heritable trait. The correlation between identical twins is stronger than for fraternal twins. Full siblings raised together are more similar in their schooling than half-siblings. By some estimates, about 20% of the variation in how long people stay in school is explained by the variation in people's genes. In 2013, a team of scientists headquartered at Erasmus University Rotterdam brought together data from dozens of medical studies. They looked for variants in the DNA from more than 100,000 people that correlated with their educational attainment. They found dozens of variants that were more common in people who finished more school than in those who left early. How long people stay in school depends on a lot of factors, such as motivation and attention. But intelligence plays a part, too. A small amount of the variation in the years people spend in school is explained by their intelligence test scores. The Rotterdam team suspected that a few of the genetic variants that influence educational attainment also influence intelligence. They picked out 69 variants from their educational attainment study and investigated whether any of them had a link by examining 25,000 people who had provided DNA and had taken intelligence tests. In 2015, they reported three variants. Each of the three variants could lift a person's IQ score only 0.3 of a single point. They did not explode like fireworks. They merely popped like champagne bubbles. These successes spurred other researchers to merge their studies, hoping to find more variants in larger groups of people. In a 2017 study, an international team analyzed nearly 80,000 people. They found 52 genes, which they were then able to confirm by turning to other groups of people and finding them once more. Altogether, the genes still account for only a small percent of the variation in people's test scores. And when the scientists looked at each gene's function, no compelling story of biology emerged. A few of the genes control the development of cells throughout the body. A few others are responsible in particular for various tasks inside neurons. Some may work in hidden pathways that scientists have yet to uncover.